Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Nice to have you all with us today. I've got to admit, I'm getting back up to speed. I'm just back from 10 days of vacation. My wife and I took off and went out to the Pacific Northwest and had a great 10 days. I want to thank Bradley George for filling in for me while I was gone. So I'm kind of like you out there today. I'm going to have to listen to the panel because they know a lot more than I do because I'm just catching up on what's going on. So before I introduce him, a couple of quick notes. First of all, we go to our new schedule starting on July 23rd, Monday, July 23rd. You've heard me say this before. Thanks to you and the fact that you've told us how much you like the show, we're adding another day. Starting on the 23rd, that week will be on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Two-Way Street will continue on Thursdays at 2 o'clock. But we hope you'll join us for that added day of Political Rewind. And also, something I don't mention often enough, if you like listening to this show and everything else you hear on GPB Radio, go to our Facebook page at GPB News and like us. We want to build our followers on Facebook. Okay, enough of the announcements. Let me introduce everybody who's on the show with us. Greg Bluestein is here, a political reporter for the AJC. Greg, I'm glad you could be with us.
Thanks for having me. I can't go to the Pacific Northwest until after the runoff, so.
I timed it so that I'd be back in time for most of the campaign. But speaking of you, though, are you doing your podcast these days? Because I don't mention it enough.
We are.
Tell
us what
it's called.
We just taped it this morning, and we pretended like we know what's going on.
Don't give away our secrets, Greg.
Tamar and I were on it today. It was called the Politically Georgia Podcast.
Politically Georgia.
You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcast.
Okay, so Bluestein writes about politics for the Dead Tree edition of the paper, and he also is in the Political Insider blog on a regular basis, as is the woman sitting across from him, Washington correspondent for the AJC, Tamar Hallerman. But we have you in town today.
Yay, I'm here.
Tell everybody why you're in Atlanta.
Well, I want to see all you. No, not really. I'm running the Peachtree Road Race for the first time. I'm absolutely terrified.
Wow.
I was looking up the race map, Cardiac Hill. Oh, my God. What did I get myself into?
Straight up the road.
If you find me in a pool of blood later, in the middle of Peachtree Road.
No, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. State Senator Elena Parent, Democrat from DeKalb County, thank you for being back today. We enjoy having you.
I'm excited to be here.
All right.
Thank you, Bill.
And next to you in the studio, Todd Rehm, Republican consultant and the overseer of GeorgiaPundit.com. Todd, I was looking at your newest page today, and it really is true. I say it a lot, that if you really want to know what's going on in local political news around the state, you're the place to go. And today is a perfect example of that. You got lots of good local political stories on the page today.
Thanks. I think that it's important to kind of keep up with what's going on, not just at the state level, but at the local level, because so much state legislation arises as a response to concerns that are first brought to county commissioners and city councils.
You could probably make up a phrase about that. You might say, all politics is local.
Never heard that one before.
By the way, of course, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Just go again to the GPB News Facebook page, and we are there for you. One last note before we get into the conversations. I've mentioned Catherine Cummings with some regularity on the show because she's one of our most regular tweeters, and she's been such a wonderful supporter of the show. Catherine, today you have posted a picture on Twitter of your youngest grandson, and the message is, introducing my youngest grandson to Political Rewind today. He can't wait to listen, and he is very cute, Catherine. We hope he enjoys the show. Greg Bluestein, let's get going. I've taken up enough time with non-relevant political news. Early voting started this morning across the state. I guess the big concern that everybody is feeling among the candidates out there is whether anybody's going to show up to vote this time around?
It's hot. It's sticky. People are on vacations. They're getting ready for the Peachtree Road Race, whatever it might be. We've got 3 weeks of early voting that just started this morning. And even for the highest profile races up at the top of the ticket, the Republicans running for governor, they're worried about a lack of interest and a lack of turnout coming. And then look across the ballot to the Democratic side. Their highest profile race is the school superintendent race that is, you know, not exactly a very barn burner. And there's the 6th and 7th district races that are equally important, but it's hard to get voters' interest in those races right now.
So what does that mean? This is my toss-up question. Well, Todd, let me go to you first. You're the Republican on the panel today. What do you think, if in fact we think turnout is going to be particularly low, is there a way to gauge whether that favors, in the gubernatorial race, Cagle or Kemp, or is that irrelevant to whether or not to who wins that contest?
I'll offer first this observation. In 2010, Governor Nathan Deal came, I want to say maybe he came in second in the first time out.
He sure did.
If you look at the difference in the raw votes, the total number of votes cast in the primary and in the primary runoff, there were enough new voters in the runoff in 2010 to completely account for Governor Deal's margin of victory that year.
You are so right. Elena, you were nodding. Not only did Nathan Deal finish second, he finished a fairly distant second to Karen Handel in the primary race. And as Todd points out, was able to come back in the runoff because new Republicans turned out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be some people where there's a large field that don't sort of want to battle out. Try to decipher between a huge number of candidates. They feel a little more comfortable once it gets down to two to casting their ballot. But it really overall just makes the point of how much of a surprise and how erratic primaries can be, and especially primary runoffs when no matter what, turnout is very low.
And I think that dynamic from Hall County probably advantages Casey Cagle, especially since the business community in Hall County has really gotten used to having hands on the levers of state government.
Yeah, Hall's an interesting one, too, though, because Nathan Deal won Hall County by about 64% of the vote in that primary.
We need to remind listeners that both Nathan Deal and Casey Cagle call that home.
So that's their backyard. And so Deal pretty much relied on Hall County to get him into the runoff back in 2010. Cagle did well in Hall County, but not nearly as well as Nathan Deal did. He got about 49% of the vote. So he technically didn't win. I mean, he got the plurality, but he didn't win his own home county. And so I think Hall County in the runoff will be really important. And Kemp is making a big play there. He had two campaign stops there last week. So he is trying to, and that is one of the biggest outside of Metro Atlanta bastions of Republican votes in Georgia. So I'll be watching Hall County in particular really closely.
Tomorrow, we've said it before on this show, you know, when you're forced into a runoff, Cagle, you know, Cagle, like a lot of candidates, are looking at, is there a possibility I can get over the finish line in the primary? And when you can't do it, runoffs are so totally unpredictable, even though Cagle has the money advantage. He has many other advantages in terms of the PACs that are behind him. But you never know in a runoff.
Yeah, as Greg was saying, I mean, it's hot outside. The last thing people want to do maybe is think about politics. People want to disconnect. A lot of people are going on their final vacations while their kids are still out of school. You know, the governor's race or any other race, like the superintendent's race or the congressional races, that, you know, unless you're weirdos like us, that's not going to be at the top of your mind. So a lot of people are not expecting a ton of new voters beyond who came out in the primary, but it'll be interesting to see if perhaps there are this year.
I'll tell you what I use to gauge what I expect turnout to be, and that is church attendance the Sunday before the election, because I can tell you this Sunday was the fewest people I've ever seen in our sanctuary heading into the July 4th week. And I think that's a pretty good indicator of how, you know, whether the mass of folks are on vacation or not. So you want to have me in the Monday before that Tuesday election.
Later, we also have to think about Republican contests for lieutenant governor. Boy, if people aren't paying attention to Kemp Cagle, how are they going to be paying attention to whether David Schaefer gets across the finish line in the lieutenant governor's contest?
A lot less mileage to make up, though, because I think he was at 49. Yeah, so that'll be, that is an interesting one to watch, though. But again, as you said, Bill, the unpredictability, you just, you never know. I remember one state House candidate who was the incumbent, I think this was last cycle, got the most round of votes, but didn't quite clear the runoff, and then he was defeated.
It happens.
I would argue that two of the predominant factors in runoffs are this: if an incumbent gets forced into a runoff, they almost always get defeated.
Good point.
And it's even more pronounced at the county and at the city level. The second thing is, I think that runoffs do stay true to form to this extent. The guy with the money usually ends up winning.
Hmm.
And if you think back, 2016 was, I believe, the first late May primary we had. Fell on my birthday of all days. And David Perdue's money advantage took him over the top against Jack Kingston in that race. So I'd say watch the money, and that's a pretty good predictor.
So what have I missed, Bluestein, in terms of how that money's being spent right now?
Well, I'm glad you asked. in the governor's race, we all know that Cagle does have the big money advantage over Brian Kemp. Just in ads alone, in sheer ads alone, Cagle's campaign has reserved about $2 million worth of airtime, where Kemp is about $1 million. But that doesn't account for the outside spending. And this pro-Cagle outside group, Changing Georgia's Future, something like that, has already reserved more than well over $1 million in outside spending. It's about $6 or $7 million. But $1.1 million alone in Metro Atlanta ads for the last couple weeks of the race. So that means that they'll be spending more on Metro Atlanta TV than Kemp's campaign has spent for the whole runoff cycle so far. Now, that could change, but that's a lot of money for ads that will just, anytime you turn on Fox News, and for Republicans, that's their... that's the sort of wheelhouse. You'll see a Cagle ad, it looks like.
All right. But, Tamar, you know, I as the oldest guy in the room, I think, like Greg does, I think, oh, well, TV. Cagle has all the money for TV. Kemp's going to have a hard time catching up. But social media is so important, and I'm seeing so much activity by Kemp. The Kemp people may have a money disadvantage, but they're trying to maximize their use of social media, and I think we know that has some power these days.
Yeah, for sure. I have him on my tweet deck, and there's all these, you know, selfies of him at barbecues and stuff going around talking about his tour. He mentioned that Kemp is going, it's like 37 stops in the next week. Mm-hmm. He's all over the place. And Facebook, especially for a lot of the politicians I cover up in D.C., it's a much cheaper way for them to spend and reach out to folks. So I think, you know, people aren't using that as their primary way to get in touch with people, but it is interesting to see how much it's just seen as an easy way to reach out to folks.
But Josh McCoon won Facebook in the primary.
Yeah, and it didn't help him.
And so if you see somebody using a money-heavy strategy the way President Obama did the first time, he spent, I think, $100 million his first campaign on social media, then you can see where it comes to make a difference. But simply relying on an echo chamber of a few hundred or maybe even a couple thousand, that didn't get Josh McCoon very far.
Okay, so I'm not as old-fashioned as I thought I might be. Is that what you're saying, Todd? Let me jump the rundown a little bit here. We were going to talk about the new composition of what appears to be voters in Georgia, and we will in a minute, but as long as we're on the governor's race, Elena Parent, let me talk to you about this. Since we're talking Cagle-Kemp, We seem to have, as we move toward especially the final days of this runoff, a greater competition than ever for which of them can be the Trumpiest candidate.
Right, right.
Both Cagle and Kemp vying for that role. Are you seeing that unfold?
Oh, absolutely. And that's pretty uniform within the Republican Party these days. President Trump has, despite low approval ratings that have remained low, you know, since the inception of his presidency, has still had very high approval ratings among Republicans, and Georgia is no exception. So that's the way they're headed. And if you're trying to win right now, I guess that's something you'd be focused on. I think that could cause the party a lot of damage long term. But for right now, I understand the strategy.
You just showed me something from your phone.
Yeah, I'm looking at a screenshot of Casey Cagle's last campaign ad that came out just a couple days ago. It's a picture of him at a mic, and it says in the caption that his campaign wrote is conservative Casey Cagle, just like President Trump.
Wow.
So both candidates, I was out with Lieutenant Governor Cagle a week or so ago at a campaign stop in North Georgia. And one of the first things, I think it was the first thing out of his mouth at the campaign stop, was a sort of opener saying, well, you know, Donald Trump could cure cancer and the media would still be all over him. And it got a huge roar of applause, but that just showed you how both candidates are just trying to soak up the Donald Trump vote because they know that he is so popular within the Republican electorate.
All right, Tamar. One manifestation of this was in this past week. While I was away, I think this happened, but I was trying to keep up on it. You had Cagle attacking Judd Apatow, one of the biggest, most successful producers in Los Angeles right now, a huge, huge force in the industry. He did some tweeting that was probably totally off the wall, comparing Trump to Hitler. I mean, you know, there are many reasons you might want to criticize that. But it seems kind of arbitrary for a candidate for governor to go after a guy who makes pictures in Georgia and who's, you know, who's an industry leader. It just seemed like an odd place for him to land. There are plenty of ways he can prove that he's just like Trump without going after a guy who brings money into the state.
Well, yes and no, right? I mean, yes, Judd Apatow has shot several movies in Atlanta, including Anchorman 2. As somebody who loves Anchorman 1, I do not recommend Anchorman 2. you know, but there's the whole culture war thing. It's a very easy way to rack up points with conservatives, to beat up on Hollywood. Why not? You know, it worked for Casey Cagle on Delta. It was an easy way to get conservatives behind him. And then also, you know, he still is a few weeks, you know, it's only been a few weeks since the whole secret tape scandal where he was caught on tape saying he supported, quote, bad public policy because he didn't want a rival to get, you know, a bunch of campaign money. This helps change the subject, as our colleague Jim Galloway mentioned in a
Sunday
blog post.
Column, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But on the other hand, you know, should he win, he's going to have to deal with Hollywood in a way. The state has worked really hard since 2008 to bring Hollywood into Georgia, and that'll be something he needs to work with if he wins.
The political problem with attacking Judd Apatow is that my father, who is probably closer in age and everything else to the average Republican primary voter, said to me, "Judge who?" And I think Peter...
You didn't see Anchorman 2?
I think Peter Fonda would have been a much better target, that my father would have understood what was going on.
Surprised he didn't just lump them both in to cover all the bases in the tweet.
Or all the Fondas.
Yeah, I think I mean, I hate to pick on him while he's on vacation, but the funniest thing about Galloway's column about all this is that he thought none of us knew who Judd Apatow was, which just shows us that maybe he, at least in spirit, is the oldest guy who's on political rewind. Look, let's do this. Let's take a break because we're set up now, I think, for the conversation that will tell us a little bit maybe about where we're headed in November. If the candidates for governor are pushing so far to the right now, so far in Trump's direction, does the data that we're extracting from the primary voters give us some clue as to what possibly could happen in the fall when the general election campaign is underway? We'll do that after this break.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows, you're all sealed inside, take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
We're back. Tamar Hallerman, State Senator Elena Parent, Todd Rehm, Greg Bluestein in the House for today's show. One last comment about Hollywood.
Well, I was a little stunned at it because that tax break, which was first pushed by Governor Sonny Perdue and then later on Governor Deal took on his own, that's one of the few things where all the candidates are on the same page. Even doing the really contentious primary, Cagle and Kemp, Kemp wants to do a review of all tax breaks, but he said, you know what, that one's already been reviewed. That one already has shown a lot of economic support. Stacey Abrams is a fan of it. Governor Deal goes out to Hollywood once a year to court Hollywood producers and remind them of how lucrative this tax break can be for them.
Right. I can't consider it that surprising, though, after the Delta tweet. But what I think is regrettable about both the Delta tweet and even more so perhaps the Judd Apatow tweet is that, you know, private citizens, yeah, if you're in Hollywood, you know, he's a public figure. He's going to put things on Twitter. He should expect some blowback. But I think what's regrettable is that we used to expect higher standards out of our elected leaders. And that has changed. It was already on sort of a downward trajectory. Trump has certainly totally destroyed the notion of sort of comedy and respect and standards out of elected leaders.
Let me, if you don't mind, ask you a follow-up to that, Elena. You point out that Judd Apatow, certainly is free to tweet what he wants to tweet. But if I, as a private citizen, am offended by Judd Apatow comparing Donald Trump to a Nazi, to Hitler, and I feel like I ought to respond to him. What are you saying about the level of discourse? In other words, your complaint is that a level of discourse that the lieutenant governor was showing in this case, it sounds like, and yet isn't it?
Yeah, I believe that there is a difference between people, or there historically has been, and those who have been elected to lead our country and our state did not used to behave in such a low fashion.
Gotcha. All right, Todd.
I want to say this, though. I see the same disturbing trend on social media among lay people. People that I've had lunch and dinner with, people that I know to be good Bible-reading, God-fearing, family-raising folks who are just beating the heck out of each other on Facebook over stuff that I'm not certain they really understand what they're saying at times. And it's gotten poisonous enough that I said this the last time I was in this room, that I will not discuss immigration, any part of immigration, with anybody, period, because it's gotten so poisonous. And so much of our civic discourse has gone the way of I don't know what. It's really distressing.
And I will tell you that it's one of the things that we work very hard to counter on Political Rewind.
Amen.
We look for a civil conversation, and we succeed a lot of the time. All right, Greg, we talk about Kemp and Cagle trying to out-Trump one another. We talk about Cagle going after a Hollywood producer to try to attract support from the Georgia right. Now we're going to end up with a candidate for governor in that race after July 24th. They're going to have to go into the general. When we look at the data that you have the co-byline on this story, Black and Democratic voters gain on Republicans in Georgia. What can you say that the data you all have crunched shows that Black voters rose 43% in the May 22nd primary, while white votes declined by, 9% over 2010? Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, we waited for a while for this data from the Secretary of State's office, and my colleague Mark Nisi crunched it. We got, I guess, Thursday. We had already seen some independent data, but we wanted to wait for the state data. It showed exactly that. We compared it to 2010, which is the last time we had a truly competitive primary on both parties. That was a wide open race for governor. In 2014, Jason Carter ran unopposed, and Nathan Deal had two, lower profile Republican opponents. And it showed exactly that. It showed that the number of Black voters rose 43% compared with 2010. The number of white voters was down 9% compared to the same year. The overall Republicans outvoted Democrats in the primary in 4 years ago by about 260,000 ballots, and this year it was only about 56,000 ballots. While the total number of non-white voters rose 46% since 2010, only one-tenth of those new non-white voters pulled Republican ballots. So that shows you that there's a more diverse electorate, and they're tending to lean a little bit more towards the Democrats.
I'm going to present what my state senator called before this show alternative facts. And that's this.
I was just wondering if they were. I wasn't accusing you.
and she did say it civilly and as a friend and as somebody who ultimately ends up on my ballot every 2 years. But what I've been interested in since people have been talking about these new Democratic voters is what percentage of them are truly new in that they did or did not show up in November of 2016. And after I saw Greg's numbers this morning, I went ahead and ran my own numbers. And African Americans, here's the real difference. Between 91% and 92%, depending on how you calculate it, of the African Americans who voted in the Democratic primary on May 22nd, 91% to 92% of them also voted in the November 2016 general election. They are not really adding appreciably to the number of Democratic votes that will be there in November. Now, 8 points is enough to swing a lot of your second-tier statewide offices, but there's not a single congressional race that's within 8 points. I don't think there's even a single congressional race that's within 16 points.
Well, that's an interesting way to frame this because
the off handle was four points.
But that's not that was a special election. We're not going to have any special elections in November. The other part of it is that much of the growth, as Chris Hutman pointed out in the original that started this whole ball, much of that growth came in the 6th and 7th districts, which is, and part of that is almost certainly due to the fact that local government is dominated by Republicans. If you want to vote for the sheriff or the county commissioners, usually you've had to pull a Republican ballot. Sometimes you didn't even have Democrats on the ballot.
Reem is trying to rain on your parade, Democrat parent.
Well, I mean, there are a couple things that, and I take his point. His point is, yes, we may be seeing a upsurge in Democratic early participation and enthusiasm, but it might not on the general ballot swing the governor's race. However, I do think it's notable that he commented that it would potentially be enough to swing some down ballots statewide, which we're all watching, of course, very closely, especially if there's higher fall off on the Republican balloting than there was on the Democratic balloting, which
almost always happens. Republicans are much worse at filling out the ballot than Democrats are.
Well, that's so funny. We always say how much worse Democrats are. But this, in the primary, it was the Republicans that were worse.
So I have to say, and I know that on this show, while I was gone, this was talked about, but I got to say, Tamar, if we think that Democrats might be, or the African Americans, others who we think might vote Democratic, are more energized for the fall. And then if you also throw in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her astonishing victory in New York, in the New York congressional race, I just wonder if these aren't little signs that there could, that I get New York isn't Georgia. Nevertheless, are there some signs out there that a Stacey Abrams might have more traction than a lot of people want to give her credit for right now?
I don't know. I was talking to Greg about this morning and whether the surge in, African-American participation in the primary this year versus 2010, what that means for Stacey Abrams, because her whole campaign hinges on registering, minority voters, people, low propensity voters. And perhaps that is encouraging. Me covering some of the congressional races in Metro Atlanta, I'm simply just not seeing even though there are new candidates, a surge of first-time candidates who, many of whom, had not been involved in politics before, I'm not necessarily seeing,
I don't think it's going to come in the congressional. Well, it could. We have no idea what could happen in the 6th and the 7th, really, yet, Greg. But I still look at that governor's race and at a young, energetic candidate like Stacey Abrams. And while I think you'd still be a lot better off voting for a Republican to win that race, I just wonder if there's something happening here that we may only now be starting to detect.
Yeah, and our strategy doesn't just depend on energizing liberal voters and minority voters, but also on firsthand contact, on contact with those voters. And I was just at a press conference with her a couple hours ago. It was one of those sort of Democratic unity ticket press conferences. And she said that she reached 1.8 million voters in her in the primary round, and that she's scaling up considerably to try to reach out to at least that many, if not many more, for the general round. And, you know, a lot of people criticized that voter outreach model in the primary, and it got her to 76 or 77% of a vote. It might not have been the only factor, but it certainly, I think, helped.
What do you think, Todd?
I think that I'd be a lot more concerned if Stacey Abrams' ideological profile were closer to that of Stacey Evans, whom she vanquished in the primary. If you'll think back to 2014 and 2016, every time we would come in here, Theron Johnson was absolutely obsessed with the unaffiliated white female vote, because right. that is the largest chunk of votes that is up for grabs. And it feels as though Stacey Abrams is sort of abandoning the center and leaving it to the Republicans to get as many of those votes, the center ideologically. And she's not even, it feels like she's not even trying to appeal to those.
But there are a couple other things going on. I agree with you, and has been pointed out on this show and in many newspaper articles, that both sides have sort of never been more polarized. Both have not really been hewing to the center of this dialogue thus far, which basically still leaves the entire middle up for grabs. And in the current environment, that could end up favoring Abrams and the Democrats. One of the interesting points from the data that you described, Greg, is that you're comparing 2018 numbers, primary numbers, to 2010 numbers. Well, what was going on in 2010? That was Tea Party backlash against the Obama presidency. 2018, we're seeing Democratic and independent voter backlash against Trump, and marches in the streets practically every weekend.
And going back to that debate about the middle, you know, the Republican runoff is going to continue to be testy over the next few weeks, and they are going to drive to the right, but at some point they will move a little bit back toward the center. Democrats, though, because they don't have a runoff battle, they don't call it a pivot, but it is what it is. They're talking much less about the very progressive ideological issues that drove the primary, and a lot more this morning, it was about expanding Medicaid, which Democrats don't see as a partisan issue. They look point to polls that show a majority of voters support expanding Medicaid, about putting more funding into K-12 schools, which is a pretty, you know, broadly consensus type of issue, and about helping out struggling Georgians with more tax incentives.
You know,
jobs is the third thing. That's exactly right, Greg. That's the platform.
You know, Tamara, it's interesting to me. We are seeing nationally, and you see it on the Hill, this struggle that's already been alluded to on the Democratic side between the most progressive, say, Bernie Sanders-style Democrats and the more traditional Democrats. And we saw that in that New York congressional race. Who's going to win that battle? We really don't know, but it's got the same potential to break apart the Democratic Party that we see in the Republican Party between the mainstream and the right, but not so much here in Georgia.
It's interesting. Like you're especially seeing it with healthcare, where, you know, Obamacare initially, when it was adopted, it was something Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts, and now all of a sudden you're hearing all these Democrats saying Medicare for all, single payer system. So you're seeing that, and you're also seeing it, you know, and I know we'll talk about this later, playing out on the immigration debate and how much is too much when it comes to kind of accommodating and cutting deals. So that'll be something to watch too.
Yeah, but do you agree, Elena, that Georgia, you're not seeing the same split really here among the most liberal Democrats fighting against the more traditional party?
Right now,
this
we
state
don't have
doesn't,
that. No.
You don't have that right
No, because
now.
We've been, you know, the minority party. So, of course, we all have our own ideological orientation, and there are some divides among members of both caucuses. It's not been anything, it's not been too stark. It hasn't been, you know, like the religious liberty versus Fortune 500 camp stuff.
Yeah, but when Stacey Evans got in the race last year, I did think, and a lot of people around her thought she would run as the more moderate. You know, her approach was always different than Abrams, and she always was talking about reaching out to the unaffiliated female voters who might have been Republicans in the past but could break Democratic. But as the campaign went along, she even moved further left, and then by the end, she was trying to push herself, frame herself as the more progressive candidate who had never turned her back on Democratic ideals and tried to say that Abrams was someone who, you know, didn't endorse Mayor Bottoms and things like that. So that to me was something of a surprise. I thought it would be more of a traditional mainstream Democrat versus progressive Democrat, but it ended up being more, who's the biggest progressive standard
bearer? Yeah, I mean, if anyone knows Stacey Abrams and has watched her career for a long time, you'll see that she actually is pretty pragmatic there as a member of her caucus and, you know, someone who was in the other chamber the whole time. Stacey Abrams, honestly, has never been some flame-throwing liberal, and Evans herself is quite progressive, so that wasn't really.
Well, that was
to me.
One of the criticism. That was one of the things the Evans people threw at her, that she was too willing to compromise with the Republicans as leader of the African American caucus in the House. All right, let's move on.
The whole caucus in the House.
I'm sorry. That's right. The Democratic caucus in the House. All right, Greg, we saw something like 700 rallies across the United States over the weekend on Saturday. People who out there in the streets angry about the separation of families at the border. We had, according to the Atlanta police, 4,000 people showed up in Atlanta. Is this a one-off, or does it have some impact beyond one day of demonstrating? Is immigration as an issue? Reem doesn't even want to talk about it. Is it going to be an issue moving forward in the sense that will it motivate people to turn out to vote?
I think it will in congressional races. And I got the chance to moderate a debate for the 6th district candidates, both the Democratic candidates for the 6th district race last week. And it was a big issue for them. Kevin Abel is a South African immigrant. Lucy McBath, both are very strong on some sort of comprehensive immigration legislation that prevents this, you know, any future president forever taking this policy. And I think it's something they think that can energize voters in a hot and sweltery summer who might not otherwise go to the polls to vote for them.
But that's kind of a Pyrrhic victory if you win the Democratic primary in a district that's 60% Republican, nine times out of 10.
Don't think it's 60% any longer, though, Todd. That district, I don't believe it would be accurate to say it at this point that it's a 60% Republican.
All right. It's pretty heavy.
But either way, a Republican maybe leaning or somewhat split district, either way you want to put it, they think they can energize their voters. And maybe best what Ossoff had last year, which is 48%. Using issues, not just this is not a single issue candidacy, but both of them are pouncing on this issue to try to mobilize their supporters.
Tamar, Politico had a headline piece this morning saying, if you think immigration is dead in Congress, you're wrong. It's going to continue to haunt them. Do you really think that's going to happen through the summer once they're back from recess? Are they going to take
absolutely.
Up immigration again?
No. I always say immigration is the issue that can never quit Capitol Hill. I've been doing this full time on Capitol Hill for 6 years now. And every year I spend at least 3 months, covering the immigration debate that everybody was forced to have, because Congress hasn't really dealt with this issue in a comprehensive way since the 80s. So there's so many issues that have been left unresolved. So whenever there's some big crisis in the courts or at the border, there's a ton of pressure. But the problem is that the two sides are so dug in, as Todd said, that nobody's willing to talk to each other. So they try and build consensus in their own caucuses. It's not there, but they're
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. So, I mean, this fall, you're going to see it on multiple fronts on Capitol Hill, as that Politico story alludes to. First of all, you're going to have the border wall issue. President Trump is insisting that Congress pay for part of his border wall. Initially, there was talk of about $1.6 billion, which I personally think is a number Democrats might have been willing to swallow. Now he wants $5 billion this year. I think that'll be a really, really heavy lift that could end up in a shutdown situation. You also have action in the courts. There could be something coming up on DACA with the Dreamer kids coming up,
that will undoubtedly
spark, all sorts of activism on both sides. You're going to have probably a court ruling on the child separation thing, and the president's executive order to keep the kids with their parents while in detention.
Is the Republican delegation on the Hill split on this issue, or are they going to pretty well line up on the conservative end on this one?
You know, it's interesting. There were two votes in the last few weeks on two different Republican proposals in the House. The more conservative plan, the one that would have given legal status but not citizenship to DACA kids, that's the one that got support from 9 out of 10 Georgia Republicans. Yeah. What was considered the more moderate version, which had a path to citizenship, that pretty much evenly split our Republicans. So they're pretty, they're pretty united on kind of the conservative side of this issue.
All right. Let's do this. Let's get another break. One thing before we go to our break, Greg Bluestein, Nick Ayers, our friend who emerged on the political scene as an aide to Sonny Perdue, was the wunderkind who was given credit for shaping what was a no-win campaign that Sonny Perdue won, and now is the vice president's chief of staff. There's even been these whispers that Nick could be a possible replacement for John Kelly as the president's chief of staff, but he's got to get out of it. Kind of a problem in terms of his campaign. He worked on behalf of Governor Greitens in Missouri. In fact, let me turn to you, Todd. Let me talk to you about this one. You're the Republican in the room. This has to do with money being funneled to the campaign that may be illegal contributions, and Nick seems to be in the thick of it.
Well, and I would first mention that Georgians were in the thick of that Greitens campaign. Austin Chambers,
that's right. Yeah.
who was a very impressive young man with David Perdue's campaign here, was the campaign manager out there. I think it is a problem of perception at the very least. Whenever I see folks who are somebody like Nick Ayers, who has not just had a great deal of success politically, he's had a great deal of financial success. When I see suggestions that somebody like him may have thrown away his future essentially and his money stream over what is really pretty small money, that always makes me think, well, he's a Republican. He ought to know enough to run the numbers and say, unless I'm pocketing enough money to get out of the country scot-free, it's just not worth it.
All right. We don't have time to talk about it more. We'll watch this as it unfolds. I will say this, and we'll do it on the shows next week. I believe that this thing, it better blow up awfully big before it's going to threaten Nick Ayers' future as a Washington consultant. I just don't personally see that this is the issue that will take down anybody real quick.
I think more than anything, there are reports that he's very loyal to Pence. He's done a lot to insulate Pence. And Trump, who's so obsessed with personal loyalty, I think that might be more of a problem to him than anything Ayers did as a political consultant.
Good. All right. Thank you for that observation. Let's get another break out of the way. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, rapper, producer, screenwriter, and film director Boots Riley. He's the son of grassroots activists and frontman for The Coup, a hip-hop band whose members describe themselves as a revolutionary music collective. His new film, Sorry to Bother You, starring Atlanta's Lakeith Stanfield, is a social satire inspired by his time as a telemarketer. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, here on GPB.
I wasn't expecting to hear that underwriting come up, but let me tell you, Sorry to Bother You is a picture that my wife and I saw at the Sundance Film Festival. You should really listen to this show coming up. It's the craziest movie we've ever seen, and it's worth listening to a conversation about it. One of the things that happened, of course, last week was and I know it's been talked about on this show as it has on every show that is following the news, is the murders at the Capitol Gazette where 5 people were killed. Without talking about it in great detail, I picked up the Sunday Atlanta Constitution yesterday, and I read editor Kevin Riley's op-ed piece about what this shooting means through the eyes of someone who works for a local newspaper right here in Atlanta. And I was moved by it, and I asked Kevin if he would come into the studio this morning and record for us his observations. And I'd like to play them for you, and on the other side, we'll talk about it a bit.
We live in a time when plenty of people would like you to think that journalists somehow exist outside the norms of our society. But the truth is, we're a lot like you. We live here, work here, commute in the cars and on the trains alongside you. Our kids go to school here, and we practice our faith along with you. we love our jobs and consider them crucial to our society and our democracy. Like so many of you, we work for what we believe is a greater good. It can be a tough profession. News erupts at inconvenient times. We show up in difficult and dangerous situations, all in an effort to keep you informed, to let you know what's really going on. We ask questions on your behalf, often of people who'd rather not answer them. And we make powerful people angry every day. For example, state and local officials were furious with us during our coverage of 2014's ice storm that paralyzed Atlanta. We revealed poor planning and a lackadaisical response from many leaders and organizations. But we believe our coverage forced Metro Atlanta's leaders to better prepare for ensuing storms. And we consider it a badge of honor to face our critics. And it's common for one of our reporters to attend a press conference called to specifically vilify their story. Those situations breed strong bonds and trust in each other, and it creates an esprit de corps that's at the heart of every newsroom. And like you, we spend countless hours together with and get close to the people we work with. We see this tragedy in Maryland as one that affects our extended family, a horrifying story that arrived right at our desks. But in the end, we were also proud of something that our colleagues at the Capital Gazette did. Under incredibly trying circumstances, they performed the foremost duty of newspapering. They published. So even as they coped with the unspeakable tragedy of dead and injured colleagues, they didn't take a break from their duty to the public, and Friday's edition arrived at the appointed time. The headline on the front page said, "Five Shot Dead at Capitol." They printed pictures of their dead colleagues. They told this story to their readers, as they have told so many others. As all newspapers have told the most important stories on the most important days in the history of their communities. God bless them. That's what newspaper journalists sign up for. And during the time when civility seems at a premium, and when we are criticized and often misunderstood, we take pride in this noble profession. And we grieve the loss of these fellow journalists and commit ourselves to the sacred duty of the free press in our democracy.
That's Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, your boss, Greg Bluestein. Mm-hmm. I don't think Kevin would be terribly upset if I said that as he read that. It's one thing to write words like that. As he read them this morning in a studio, he choked up. It was hard for him to get through it at times.
It was tough. I mean, just any newsroom, any journalist. We were having a goodbye party at the AJC for two veteran staffers, Rhonda Cook and David Gibson, who have been with the paper for combined, I think, 60 years as this news is breaking. And so we're all kind of glancing at our phones as we're celebrating their careers and thinking that, you know, we're in our minds going through all the people who have threatened us over the years. I've had several, some pretty serious. I keep a quote with me at all times from Kevin's former right-hand man, Burt Roten, who's the former managing editor of the AJC, who just retired himself. And it's, "The way a newspaper shows its love for its community is to tell the truth." And that truth is hard sometimes. And our sources, the candidates, whoever, the politicians might not like the truth or the way we frame the truth or the what we write about the truth. And that gets us in a lot of hot water. And it gets us to the point where we do get threats and we do have people who blame us for problems. And as Kevin said, we do have even very prominent leaders say that, you know, if we shouldn't have written about the ice gridlock ellipse, whatever you want to call it. Or, you know, recently we've gotten a lot of flack about our coverage of politics and of the Delta fallout and saying, what do you want? Not want us to get Amazon? That's not our job. Our job is to tell the community the truth.
You know, Todd, it's always easy to point to President Trump as the guy who has been so hard, has fought a war against the media. And of course, he has. But we see that right here in our community in relation to what both Kevin alluded to in an indirect way and what Greg's talking about. The AJC and Channel 2 combined have done this remarkable job reporting on what was happening in city government in the last year or so of Kasim Reed's tenure. And Kasim Reed, the Democrat Kasim Reed, no Trump Republican, has been merciless in attacking the media and was doing it even before he left office. So this isn't a problem confined to one party or one president.
I will lay the blame two different places, and they're related. The first is social media, which creates these illusory relationships that aren't real relationships, where you can have a running Twitter fight with somebody whom you've never met in person. I very nearly got dragged into a Twitter fight a couple weeks ago, and I called the person who I knew who was trashing me on Twitter and just said, look, dude, there's a human being at the other end here. And with social media, it's easy to forget that there is a human being that you've never met on the other end of it. And the second is, I think part of it goes to the culture of glorified violence that largely the television industry and Hollywood are responsible for. When you have TV shows that have a protagonist who's a serial killer, I think that is part of the corrosion of our society, to where mass murder seems like a reasonable
some people. You're talking about the series Killing Eve, I think.
And Dexter. And Dexter. There was a Hannibal Lecter series. Right. I mean, there's at least three off the top of my head.
So, Elena, and Tamar, we've got just a couple minutes, but let me get you. I am much more optimistic about the public's attitudes towards the media than we're led to believe day in and day out. We know that at his rallies, Trump gets the crowd stirred up about the fake media. They boo the media, but then they come by and want autographs from all of the people who are in the pen. I mean, I think in the long run, I'm more optimistic that journalists are respected more than we sometimes think. You think I'm wrong?
I agree. I think it's in many ways and on many fronts a difficult period for a lot of institutions and certainly for our politics. But I think our institutions will be strong enough to withstand that. I just don't know that the next 20 years will be particularly easy.
Tamar, let me give you the last word. And by the way, I certainly am not trying to suggest that Trump's attacks on the media had anything to do with the shootings in Annapolis. We have no reason to think they did. We're now talking about the broader issue, whether or not you can do your work responsibly and safely.
You know, I wish I could end it on a more optimistic note. I live in constant existential, sadness about the state of our profession and all of it. Although I will say, every time I reach out to people, whenever I get emails that I wrote something that people didn't like, I always try and send them a note to just kind of show, yes, I'm a human being. I tried to be honest and make these choices. And most of the time, it's okay.
I'm the same way. I try to do the same thing. All right, look, we're completely out of time. I wish we weren't because this has been a great panel. And thank you all for getting me back up to speed after my long time off. Tamar Hallerman, Elena Parent, Todd Rehm, Greg Bluestein. By the way, we're out of here. We're certainly not going to do a show on the 4th of July because are you going to be listening? Of course not. And we're going to take Friday off as well because you should have at least the rest of the week to not worry about politics. So we will be back with another Political Rewind next Monday. I look forward to seeing you all then.